Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.
For ex-school teacher Marisela Fetty, life under Fosian rule isn't so bad. Or so it seems. After all, these four-armed alien overlords seem more interested in observing humanity's quirks than carrying out its extinction. But are the Fosians really who they say they are? Find out in Alien Housing, read and written by Karen Hewler.
Marisela Fetty had profound reservations about her job. She was old enough to miss the world as it had been, and smart enough to know that it would never be that way again. The two current beliefs, that someone would find out the alien's weakness, or that it was best to learn to live with them, both annoyed her. There were waves of aliens coming and going, and no one had figured out any weaknesses in the past 10 years. And she didn't want to live with them. Livelihoods were, of necessity, altered. The decrease in human reproduction, whatever its cause, meant that as a teacher she had been in a field now too competitive to be solvent. The world was running out of children. She took an administrative job with a large housing complex, but the aliens were interested in acquiring more housing, and they got what they wanted. They might keep her on if they liked her. She was about to be interviewed. The Fosians had not been the first aliens to arrive. Two other races had come and gone after a struggle that destroyed 3 Earth cities and no alien ships. The others left when the Fosians arrived, without comment and apparently without hostility. But the Fosians came in massive ships filled with their kind, announcing their good intentions and assuring everyone that they were friendly. Very friendly. They all needed housing and would adapt in their friendly fashion. They required a reliable temperature range, water, refrigerated storage, food preparation areas, in fact, a standard Earth apartment. Marisela had handled some of them in her old position. She would handle more of them if she actually got the job. By the time Poontz interviewed Marisela, she had gotten used to the way Fosians looked. They had 2 extra arms, one in front, one in back, and a head that swiveled, and their strangely stippled skin was gray. "You have an interesting resume," Poontz observed, checking his palm device. "Once in charge of the young, an important qualification. Our population has children and the young, the almost grown." Poontz had come with the second wave of Fosians. By then the race was universally hated, but the aliens didn't care. They didn't hurt anyone, but they also didn't realize that the spaces they took belonged to someone else. And no one felt secure with these aliens, with their higher technology, their spaceflight, their ability to speak to Earth people in their own language. All of this was difficult. But what were the choices, exactly? And what was next? Until she found that out, she needed a job. Poontz seemed to approve of her. His voice was warm and encouraging. But Fosians had nice voices. Poontz's voice came from deep in his throat or from the high point of his palate. It had an unusual vibration. She found it soothing. She found it encouraging, even if it was a Fosian trick to sound kind and caring. In fact, Fosians could mimic not only voices but movements, gestures, and even alter their appearance somewhat to look like something else. They were fascinated by dogs, for instance, and often sat next to them, letting their stippled skin take on a fur-like texture. It was much easier to hate a Phocian when they weren't speaking to you. She shifted in her seat, flexed her hand on her thigh, looked past him out the window, and reminded herself that the pay was good, and she could control her reaction to that voice. He told her she was hired, and although she was grateful, she asked, "Why me?" "Teachers," he said in that admiring voice of his, "are so helpful. Our children reach a certain age, adolescence, and they leave home and live together or travel together, often getting into mischief." "Gangs," she said, surprised. "You have gangs." "We don't have gangs," he said firmly. "They are," he paused, "peer groups," which was the kind of thing a parent would say, she noted. She could handle parents. "What kinds of things do these peer groups do?" "They play and they are reckless, but they mean no harm. We have a code of ethics, like us," he winced, "stronger than yours. But sometimes they defy constraints." So why bring them here, or dump them here, she thought to herself. She was familiar with the way parents worded their explanations of their children's bad behavior. "We bring them here to learn," Poontz said. He shifted awkwardly on his chair. Earth design did not account for forearms. Phocians sat on stools rather than chairs and preferred scooters to cars. They had large mouths with very mobile lips and a vague chin. She kept looking at that chin. "You can stare at me," he said courteously. "We stare at you." She felt her face grow hot. His politeness made her feel inferior. She had to stay professional. "What exactly do you want me to do?" "We like the wealth of alien experiences on this planet." She blinked at the word alien. For a second, she almost felt she was the alien. She shook it off. "We want our young to be comfortable with aliens, courteous, respectful. But the young can sometimes go too far. Adults know the difference between a real gun and a fake one, and the psychological differences as well. Our young might not. We encourage them to research your society, even watch your movies. They are delightful. We like the chases, the gunfights, the hurts, betrayals, vengeance, killings, wars." His voice was lovely. His voice made it all sound magical. She leaned a little closer, then sat back again. "If you're having a problem with your young, why don't you just tell them to behave better, to acknowledge your restraints?" She felt good about that, as if she'd put him in his place. "The purpose of childhood is to learn how to be an adult, no?" he asked. "They will learn. There's plenty of time." His tongue protruded. It was not as large or disgusting as the external tongue of the Bourbons, but was fairly large and unpleasant. He pulled it back in. She considered what he'd said. It implied a long stay, an easy stay. Phocians had always avoided discussing their intentions. "Why did you come here?" "To Earth." His front arm made a small, sweeping gesture. "It's just one of many planets we visit," he said kindly. "We live for a long time, and we're curious. You live for a short time, and are curious." "Are you taking over?" He stared at her. She wished she knew what that stare meant. Annoyance? Anger? Respect? "We're not interested in taking over," he said. "Then there would be no reason to visit. You would no longer be independently unique. We find you interesting." "So you won't stay forever?" She kept herself sitting straight. Sometimes, with difficult students, she had had to remove herself emotionally from any confrontation. She would straighten up, clasp her hands, and observe them from a distance. "There are other planets. Right now, this one is popular." "Because we're interesting," she said. "You are. You truly are." There was so much warmth and support in his voice. Her suspicions, if she had suspicions, she really couldn't think of any at the moment, disappeared. He seemed all right. There were some occasional housing issues, but she was mostly expected to oversee the Fosian young, who often gathered in groups. She got a call about one group and went to see what they were doing. They were hard for her to tell apart, especially since they sometimes chose to mimic each other. Her eyes swept across the group, some of them ignoring her, others staring at her with interest. Now that she was dealing with them constantly, they no longer repulsed her as much, but her best tactic was to single out one Fosian and ask it to tell the others to leave. It had sometimes worked with human adolescents, creating a connection rather than simply giving orders in a loud voice. "Why should we leave?" this Fosian asked her in a reasonable voice. "There was a group of humans here a little while ago." "This is a school building," she said. "The parents were waiting for their children." "We, too, are patiently waiting for our children," he answered. There was a pause. "Their children," he corrected. "Grammar error." The alien next to him snickered, and then the next one snickered. The snicker ran around the crowd like an excited dog. It was very annoying. But she snickered, too, and that seemed to stop them. They shrugged all four arms and left. But were they actually waiting for children? Were there younger children in those groups? Poonce said no. "Soon there will be," he said. "It will inevitably happen, but not yet." Fine. They were teenagers then, clumping together as teenagers did. They gathered outside ice cream parlors, too. Of course, there they actually purchased and ate ice cream. But they dropped the napkins and paper cone covers on the ground. She went to discuss this with Poonce. Was she complaining about the young Fosians too much? Poonce always accepted her reports without irritation, as if all of this was to be expected. But what was the Fosian experience? They probably had disappointments, irritations, displeasures. "They're not fond of the food," Poonce said. This was surprising. "They keep eating it." "They're curious. It's an oddity." "None of them have gotten sick. And they can metabolize almost anything. It's not a problem." "They throw it away. It's litter." "They've watched your habits. They're copying you. Do you want me to tell them to stop? If so, what do they do with it?" "Put it in the garbage cans. They throw food away and then try the same food again and throw it away again. So tell them the taste won't change. If they don't like it once, don't eat it again." And from that time on, they put their garbage in the cans. She was gaining authority. She was sure of it. Perhaps she had judged them harshly before. Poonce was always courteous, perhaps even kind. Movie theaters would call to say that they had been invaded by aliens who sat through the same film over and over again. She told the theater to shut off the film. They wouldn't riot. And she went there to make sure. The aliens came out in a crowd repeating lines of dialogue, shoving each other or dancing, depending on the movie. Across the street, a crowd of humans, perhaps waiting to see the film, watched with disapproval. Once, all the aliens lined up and watched the humans with equal disapproval, or that's what it looked like. She couldn't be sure. She said she would report them all to Poonce if they didn't leave immediately. But really, she thought to herself, wasn't it just as annoying for all the humans to stand there and disapprove? It seemed to be going well until the day she got a call from the police who wanted to show her something. Of course, the aliens had been up to something. A detective led her to a small office and then shut the door, motioning her to sit down. He turned his computer to face her. "I want you to see this," he said. He nodded at the screen, where a group of aliens were shown shambling up and down the aisles of a liquor store. Her eyes watched carefully. They stumbled a little, perhaps already half drunk, and one of them looked, well, there was something about it. She leaned forward. Detective leaned back, satisfied. She was aware of his movement, but she didn't turn to notice it. because she was so interested in the figure on screen, then no longer interested. Appalled. "I think that's supposed to be me," she said in a hushed tone. She had thought the camera was poor quality, but it wasn't the camera. The figures were poor quality. The features were blurred, a trifle too far apart or too close. The clothes fit in a static way, not moving the way clothes would move. But then she recognized that jacket. It was her favorite, the one she wore most often in cool weather. It had a slightly fitted waist and covered buttons and generous pockets marked by a slightly darker stitching. But here it was, blocky, with one too many buttons and stitching around pockets that didn't actually exist. With those extra arms of theirs. And her face was blunted, her eyes too far apart, her nose too large or something. "My nostrils aren't that big," she asked. He snorted. Because this was a cheap knockoff of her appearance. She didn't know who the others were. She didn't recognize the clothing or the distorted faces. But the figures walked up and down aisles, grabbing bottles, apparently at random. They brought them, wavering back and forth, up to the counter and stood, waiting. The clerk, his eyes on them, put the goods into two shopping bags. His shoulders were tense. His eyes kept darting. The figure that was hers made a pretense of taking something from its non-existent pockets and held out nothing to the clerk, whose hand moved stealthily under the counter. A silent alarm. The figure that was hers still held out the hand as if waiting for the receipt or the non-existent credit card again. The clerk looked increasingly unhappy. He glanced to the door. They all glanced to the door and then moved in a shaky group to it and out of it. She stopped the video. They were mimics, so none of it was absolutely shocking, though it was moderately shocking at least. No one likes to look at their own caricature. It was nasty. She needed to see Poonce. He had a way of making such things unthreatening. "We should have killed them all," the detective said. She glanced at the frozen screen with the Fosias dressed like her caught in profile. "How?" she asked, and then felt bad about it. Poonce set up a meeting with Vatan, who had impersonated her at the robbery. He, she, it was sitting at a cafe table with a cup of coffee steaming. She ordered the same and sat down. He sat all the way forward. That back arm they had must be annoying. They could probably take turns being a chair, she thought uneasily. And then she wondered if they could actually use part of their body to turn into a chair, and then the rest of their body could sit in the chair. "Are you feeling well today, Maricela?" Vatan asked. "Of course I am," she said. She was off her game already. The image of the alien being part chair had tripped her up. "Because you look disorderly at the edges," Vatan continued, "we often find it hard to assume a shape perfectly." "I'm not assuming a shape," she said sharply. Did he somehow know what she'd been thinking? "This is who I am. This is my shape." She took a deep breath. She would not allow him to influence her. "I am happy for you," he said. "Did you wish to ask me anything?" She needed to regain her composure and figure out what she wanted to know. "Why did you rob that store? Why did you change your appearance? How do you change your appearance? What do you want?" She had blurted it out, though luckily her tone had been reasonable. "Doing that was very educational," he said cheerfully. "I learned a lot." What had he learned? "What it is to be human. It's very fun. An unusual experience. Would you take us to the horses in Central Park? We believe they will be more comfortable than this chair." Perhaps Fosians at that age couldn't concentrate, but she still wanted to understand. She went back to Poonce. "Why would they do that?" she asked him. "Don't they know we use money?" "Oh, they know. They probably ran out or forgot to bring it. They are hasty at that age. They may have thought it really didn't matter. We study your culture, books, movies, art, TV. They like the movies and TV best. so they sometimes play out scenes. Yes, it had looked like a scene. Or surveillance camera footage. Kids at a bodega, kids acting out a robbery. Poonce's voice made it all seem so ordinary, so acceptable. Her mind, however, got stuck on one detail. They forgot to bring money, she asked. Where do they get money? Does our government give you money? It had never really occurred to her to wonder what the specific arrangements were with the aliens. They got what they wanted, obviously, since they were in charge. Was her government paying them to be in charge? Poonce nodded. Money is a novelty to us, of course, but the youngsters think it's funny. She could move on for the moment. Her government wouldn't give out handouts to their conquerors, would they? She considered the implications. What does our government get in return? Ah, his voice was sympathetic. Yes, exchange. In exchange, we give them a little of our technology, our science. Spaceships? Propulsion? Fertility treatments. You are a dying race. She had to take in a big breath and stop for a moment. Of course, the birth rate was plummeting, but no one had said it was permanent. No one had said this was the end. She looked at him sharply. Treatments? What would you know about human physiology that you'd be able to know how to do this? We are engineers with excellent memories and no wars. Your biology is not as complex as you think. That's a good thing. The Bervins are complex and aloof. The Dadii are complex and cruel. I like to believe we are complex and kind. You seem kind, at least I think so. And complex in what way? In your physiology? Culture? Your mental abilities? Yes, and perhaps as well in our intentions. Her heart beat a little faster. Was there a warning in that statement? But he sat there as benevolent as ever, leaning slightly toward her. She could almost feel his hand patting her, but of course he never would touch her. Such a thing would be ethically uneasy, even if only a friendly gesture. Why are you here? You keep asking. My people are here because they're bored, and you're a novelty. No other race is like you, exactly like you. The Dadii look for high culture of a very specific kind, and you don't have it. No one understands the Bervins, nor wants to. The Temdem are always looking for oil and get into ridiculous standoffs when they find it, but they use hydrogen fuel. No one uses oil in any quantity. I assume they trade oil somewhere primitive. Assume isn't accurate. I don't know what they do, and I don't care. She smiled. There was a trace of defiance in that, as if he had been told to care but found it demeaning. You say you're bored, and yet we constantly have problems with your youth. They never allow themselves to be bored. At their age, everything is still new. Soon they'll be interested in the universe instead of these enactments. I wonder if we should actually get them to put on a show, she said tentatively. They will not learn lines, he said sadly, but improv? Perhaps improv? He watched for her reaction. They're already doing improv, she said and laughed. Then a deep hum broke out from the back of Poonce's throat. It was his version of her laugh. She was sure of it. The young Phosians loved all the amusement parks. Coney Island, Six Flags, Disney. Water slides didn't appeal. Roller coasters did. They stood up when the coasters rocketed down. One fell, but didn't die. Instead, he landed on his back arm and broke it. Soon, others sported a cast on their back arms. They never sued, yet the owners soon refused to let them on their coasters. They were afraid the aliens would show the human boys how to unlock the safety bar, and the amusement parks would be littered with figures standing up and falling. Human figures. The aliens also loved traffic. Groups of them stood at intersections just waiting. Of course, sometimes they caused an accident just by being there, by startling people. Humans looked. They took their eyes off the road and stared at the aliens, and then crashed. And just why did they bring so many youths here, if they were youths? She really couldn't tell. Maybe it was something like the Amish Rumspringa, where they all sent out in the universe to see what other planets were like before they went back to their own planet. She wondered what their own planet was like, and if it would interest humans the way humans interested Phosians. So far, there was nothing about them that made her want to know them better. But they weren't bad, really. She caught herself surprised. They were invaders. Of course they were bad. One day she came to a group of them, all sort of huddled together with sex faces. She could tell they were sex faces, because every so often there'd be a sex moan, starting small and rising higher. They had discovered porn, obviously. It was inevitable, in hindsight. "Stop it," she said. "That's just not something you do in public. It's very private. How would you like it if we went around making your sex faces?" A Phosian answered her, "We don't make sex faces. We don't make noises. We just approach another, have a conversation, agree, and then we exchange." "Exchange?" "Watch," one of them said. And after a brief interview, two Phosians moved away from the rest, bent their heads together, made a soothing sound, and then removed their front arms and exchanged them. She closed her eyes briefly and winced, and when she opened her eyes again, the two of them were standing in front of her expectantly. It was sometimes hard to read their body language, but she was pretty sure they were grinning. "Well done," she whispered feebly. The next few days were filled with minor annoyances. The alien youths dolled themselves up as oversized traffic cones and shut down the Lincoln Tunnel for an hour. The cops had trouble getting there, and DOT didn't hurry, and by the time it all started moving again, the cones had changed back into Phosians. They didn't even try to escape. Why should they, she thought in irritation. It would interest them to see what happened next. Threats of arrest didn't stop them. They enjoyed being arrested. She hadn't seen how they looked as traffic cones. By now she knew, or at least believed, that they couldn't actually transform into a traffic cone. Instead, they would have arranged themselves in a conical shape, those arms spread out while they squatted, their bodies changing color, and watched. It was all over in an hour, most likely because there wasn't much amusement in just squatting and watching. They were restless. She didn't know if the traffic cones were an example of their sense of humor or if it was simply something they were testing out. And then it occurred to her to wonder why they would test anything out. Poonce liked to have a cup of coffee on his desk, although he never drank it. The coffee had an unpleasant metallic taste, he said. She came in and sat down, and he looked at her, sympathetic as always. "Why are you here?" she asked. "You keep asking. I've told you. We find you interesting." "What's interesting about us?" He was silent for a moment. "I suppose the best answer is that you don't look like us. You don't act like us. You don't think like us. Your culture defies reason. I include your religions. The Daddy Eye liked your music, but they could take that with them, so they left. You all live in a comedy, and we enjoy that. You can't take yourselves seriously, not really, and it's so easy to trick you. All of this is endearing. It's a good training ground for our young. After all, you are not us, and that's an endless source of education. Plus, you live in such a different way. We can see how you live, and we can live among you. It's like an amusement park." "Yes, you always like amusement parks. I don't get that." "Why do you go to amusement parks?" "For the novelty. Because they exist outside your regular life. That's why we like you. You exist outside our regular life." "I suppose that's true. And of course, you're predictable." That made her silent for a moment. but you said we're interesting. Doesn't the predictable stop being interesting? He pursed his great lips. We enjoy the pattern, if you will. We delight in the way you perform. You mean the way we live? He bowed his head. In the way you live. We will not harm you. Our children may be annoying, but they will kill no one. Why should they kill anyone? She asked quickly. Have they killed other species? No, he said. I regret the way I said it. Of course we meet antagonistic races, as you have, but it's taken care of swiftly and without individual bloodshed. It's a pleasure to be here, to see you, to sometimes play at your lives. She frowned. At how you live your lives. Are you saying we're like television to you? Like television and a theme park, or like living in a real-life hologram of your lives? She sat back for a moment, taking a deep breath. I don't think you really know us or know our lives. You keep approaching us as images, characters. I'm beginning to see that, she said. He smiled. Are you? I got a call from a very small theme park, a Wild West village. Your teenagers have been going there in groups. They go for the day and just take over. They turn their hands into guns. I think that's what it is. The owner thought they might be toys because he said they were a little odd looking. And they shoot each other and some of the employees. The bullets don't hurt. They make noises like horses. That must be some kind of confusion. He nodded pleasantly. I'm so happy they're enjoying themselves. Is it important that they enjoy themselves? We want our young to learn about adulthood and responsibility. Of course, he assured her. Youth allows them to choose their lifestyle, their career, their gender. Their gender? But I saw them exchange front arms and they said it was sex, so they must have a gender. Hoontz laughed dramatically, once again making it sound like her laugh. They have a sense of humor. That was a friendship exchange, nothing more. Your arms are detachable? She was struggling with this. How little she knew about the Phosians. How little Poons ever thought to tell her. He must assume she knew, she told herself. But how would she know? It was a joke, he said serenely. And yes, at certain points in their lives, they can detach their genitals. Genitals, she yelped. Of course. We choose our gender at different times in our lives, whatever seems appropriate. And we can decide to change again. For instance, I was male once, but now I am female. I much prefer it. Her mind stuttered and circled around. Poons was female? All of her relations with him had been based on thinking of him as male. She had a deep sense of him, of his voice, as male. She had fallen into the trap of thinking he was a leader, and a leader must be male. She was male. Her mind stuttered again. How held she felt that authority was male? It was obvious now that she did. I didn't know you were female, she said weakly. For now, Poons agreed. But it's so strange, she murmured. He looked at her, his eyes shading for a moment. She. They're coming of age if they're doing that, she said. Of course, that's why they're here. Soon they'll be reproducing. It's a natural order, don't you agree? And they'll leave then? To go back to their own planet and raise their young? All four of Poons' hands waved. You don't do that, do you? You travel, find a mate, and raise your young wherever you land. You travel, enjoy the sights, and then settle down. But you never stop wanting to have something fun to do. The fact that Poons's voice had always seemed male, and intimately male, disturbed her. It must be, she thought, some holdover of her upbringing. She was ashamed of that. She began to review her conversations with Poonz, adjusting the kind, soft voice she recalled into a kind, soft female voice. Say what you would, it was very progressive of them not to be tied to gender. Progressive, but disturbing. And the aliens, male or female, she shouldn't think it mattered, were enjoying human history via theme parks and acting out. It made them seem childlike now that she thought about it, which was entirely misleading. Poonz's revelation continued to unnerve her. She stopped for a drink at a bar and fell into a conversation with the man next to her, who snorted when she told him what her job was. "You're being seduced," he said. "We're all being seduced. I don't get it. I don't know why you like them. They're terrible." "They're fine." She still felt a little protective about Poonz especially. "They haven't shot at us, blasted from their spaceships, unloaded viruses, done anything that aliens are supposed to do." "They're killing us," he said quietly, patiently. "I think you're nuts. I admit some aliens are hard to look at, and, well, I'd rather they went somewhere else. But the Phosians, they're intelligent and sympathetic. They're on our side." "Brainwashed," he said. "I don't get it." "You're an idiot," she snapped, and turned away. Then she sighed and turned back. "I apologize. I don't know why, but I like them. Convince me that I'm wrong." He nodded. "Easy. What was the world like before they came?" "The usual. Warfare, disease, inequality, collapse of the ecosystem." "And what is it like now?" She thought for a moment. "We're not at war. There's still inequality. I don't know if the ecosystem is any better. But they haven't been here long. There are no new diseases." "Yeah, right. The population's falling." "It was falling before they came." "Seeing the human race disappear doesn't bother you?" "We're not disappearing." "You mean you like them because they haven't killed you?" "But they have killed you. You just haven't noticed yet." She got up and left at that point. She had thought most people accepted the aliens. Did that mean she did? What was bad about that? It was suddenly easy to find housing for the large ships that arrived. Landlords told her that human tenants had been leaving in groups, relocated to better housing, apparently. Fully paid up and no forwarding address. Was something happening that she should know about? Poonz would tell her. Should have told her already, of course, but he often forgot to give her information. She. "Ah, yes," the alien said, looking up at her behind the desk with the untouched coffee. "I'm glad you're here." "Something's changing with the housing," Maricela began. "Yes, I just wanted to let you know that I've made sure you'll be taken care of." Her voice was warm, but professional. "You'll have an easy trip, and I've already made sure you'll have a comfortable room. It's a very nice complex. Good heating and cooling, very nice beds, a lawn. I'm sure you'll make friends once you get there." Poonz nodded kindly. "What are you talking about? It's true? You're sending people away?" Her heart was beating a little erratically. Poonz was sympathetic. Her right arm held out, palm up. "This city really has become a caricature of itself, hasn't it? Dirty and dark and so many angry creatures. People staring and taking up space. Dangerous for you, but it's got a certain charm for us. The youngsters love to race around a corner to see what's there. Your artifacts are so amusing. Every group that comes here wants to experience all of it. We'd like to give them the real experience without the intrusions of, your people. Our young people have picked up so many of your themes from you. You've been excellent. They can recreate the things you're famous for so beautifully now. Just a few modifications physically, and this city, this country, will be a perfect fit. No conflicts between us. That's what we've decided. We'll look out for you. We want you to be safe. Please don't be alarmed. It would disturb me. Most humans don't know what to make of us, and we can see their displeasure. So there will now be a safe area for you, away from us. We'll both be happier. She was stunned. She felt a sort of vertigo. The world as she knew it had suddenly tilted. She had thought he was a man, but he was a woman. That was a turnaround in her head, but there had always been that wonderful voice. She had believed Poonce to be open and warm and caring. She had wanted to. Why had she wanted to? How is it possible to be so stupid? Another alien walked her to her apartment and watched as she packed one suitcase. From there, she was accompanied to one of a line of buses outside the office. Other humans stood around, muttering or saying bleak things. "The government! Where is the government?" one cried, and the muttering got louder, but nothing changed. On the bus, a man sat down next to her, tapping her to get her attention. "I see you've been sent away, too," he said. It was the man from the bar who hated the aliens. "I'm not surprised. Do you think they'll spare us?" That shocked her. She had not yet had such dark thoughts. "If they don't kill us," he whispered into her ear, "are you interested in fighting? Will you join the revolution? There are a few of us, and now there will be more of us, and we've learned something about them. Is it enough? I don't know." His voice dropped solemnly. "But we can't let them do this to us, can we? Steal our land and send us away? To what? Reservations? Camps? Mass burials?" "They wouldn't do that," she whispered back, her heart plunging and then skittering. "They wouldn't do that." The bus turned onto the highway heading north. An alien waved at her. She didn't want to look too closely in case it looked like her. "They probably don't even have to kill us," he admitted. "We were dying anyway." He sat back as the bus gained speed, leaving her to wonder what was ahead and why she hadn't realized what it all meant. She couldn't stop thinking that Poonce had been genuinely kind, interested, supportive. She struggled to find an excuse, and then she struggled because she couldn't. It was a nasty business. She could hear Poonce in her mind, but the voice was getting quieter as the streets gave way to highway, as the bus headed north, eventually joining a line of buses going north. Her bus passed some of them, and she saw the faces looking drearily out windows. She would wrestle with her memory of Poonce, subdue it, triumph over it, all the while wishing to hear that voice again, that treacherous voice.
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.